Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Way early this morning, Brad Higdon shared a major spoiler alert from everyone's favorite hit show, sad emojis to express his feelings about the plot twist, and a playlist he made to drown out his sorrows? Dude, oversharing alert. Brad, Geico has something worth sharing with those who haven't befriended you. Like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance at geico.com. So stop moping about the post-apocalyptic world and start saving in the real world. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hi, everybody. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Actually, we're going into adult learning, so it's actually Pre-K Forever Radio, Education Talk Radio today. We've got Dr. Lauren Rosenberg with us from Eastern Connecticut University. This is an NCTE show, National Council of Teachers of English. Okay, she's going to be talking about a book that she wrote called The Desire for Literacy, Writing in the Lives of Adult Learners. And I'll tell you some experiential stories from that, okay? But it's about adult literacy. And Lauren, hang tight for just a second, and I'll bring you on. I just got to do a little bit of homework. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org. That's our website. Excuse me, we'll put up a new schedule on Saturday, as we always do. All our shows are over there. Just keep scrolling down. You can listen to whatever you like. And also, we tweet at EduTalkRadio, at EduTalkRadio over on Twitter, obviously. And we put out a direct link before and after every show, so you can follow us over there if you like. We get a lot of good show ideas from our Twitter followers. All right, today's show, NCTE, as always, sponsored by Great Books Foundation, the independent nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to empower readers of all ages to become reflective thinkers. My voice, I don't know why, I'm cloggy right now. Reflective thinkers through the discussion of written works and ideas of enduring value. They offer educators K-12 a wide range of literature, anthologies, nonfiction materials, other classroom products that empower K-12 students to become independent readers and thinkers. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Pardon the use of the word ain't, all you English teachers. Schools that integrate Great Books materials and what they call their shared inquiry method of learning into their curriculum create school success by improving their students' critical thinking, reading comprehension, writing, speaking, and listening skills. They tweet at GreatBooksFND, and it's GreatBooks.org. GreatBooks.org, and I've talked to teachers who use that shared inquiry method, and they really love it. So check it out, English teachers. Speaking of English teachers, hello, Dr. Rosenberg. I'm Larry Jacobs. Call me Larry.
Good morning, Larry.
And by the way, Lauren, I assume it's doctor. You're Dr. Rosenberg, right?
That's right. But you can call me Lauren.
No, I'll call you. Okay, then you can call me doctor.
Okay, good.
All right, good enough. No, I'm just kidding. I don't have a doctorate. Okay, Lauren, what do you teach at Eastern Connecticut?
Well, I teach English, and especially I teach writing.
Oh, cool. And what's going on in the wacky world of college students writing these days?
They're writing a lot.
Good.
They're writing all the time. They're writing critically. They're writing creatively. They're doing all kinds of writing at school and out of school.
That's good. And do they understand how important it is to write correctly as opposed to writing the number four instead of F-O-R or something?
Well, I'm not exactly the person who's going to talk to them about writing correctly because correctness is something that I'm kind of critical of. But we do write a lot, and we do look at the issues that surround correctness. Like,
good.
Who really cares
about
correctness?
Yeah. Well, as long as you get the message across. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I love it, Lauren. That's just great. How long have you been at Eastern Connecticut?
This is my 10th year at Eastern.
Wow. Wow, great. Were you somewhere else before?
Before I was at Eastern, I was a graduate student at the University of Massachusetts. I was there for 5 years, and then I was teaching at other colleges before then, and before that, high school and middle school.
Wow, good for you. That's great. And you're the author of the NCTE Studies in Writing and Rhetoric series, the one that we're talking about, The Desire for Literacy, Writing in the Lives of Adult Learners, okay? And you can go to ncte.org, okay, /store/desire-for-literacy. Nobody's going to remember that. Just Google Lauren Rosenberg, the desire for literacy. Okay, I'll tell you a story here, Lauren. My wife used to teach adult literacy. Okay,
oh.
Adults to read, basically. When we lived in Exeter, she worked with a goodly number of people in this incredibly upscale town who couldn't read. Intelligent, great people, adults. Okay? And we're going to talk about that, but my first question I want to ask you, and these are, I met a lot of them, these are intelligent people, they were embarrassed by the fact that they couldn't read, they came forward, she taught them to read and write, it was just a heartwarming experience for my wife and for these students, but I have a question, Lauren, how do these people fall through the cracks? How can they get to be adults going through American public schools, okay, intelligent people, and I'm not kidding about that, and they don't learn how to read? How is that possible, Lauren?
That's the question that everybody has, because I think for most of us who've been reading and writing our whole lives, we take it for granted so much.
Yeah.
We can't even imagine people who are outside the culture of literacy. And like you're saying, from your wife's experience, there are a lot of people who haven't had the benefit of consistent schooling, who really haven't been able to devote their lives to studying. And you find not only are there a lot of people, but exactly like you're saying, they're really smart, curious people who've been successful in other areas of their lives. So I think, how do people fall through the cracks? Well, I think that, you know, we're sort of fed what I'm going to call a myth in our society that a free quality education is available to everyone equally. And I think what you find when you start to talk with adult learners about their experiences is that that's not true. And they may even still believe that it's true to some extent. But what happens is that because of all kinds of reasons, usually material reasons in their lives, almost always linked to poverty, but not 100%, people don't get access to quality education or education at all, or they had to leave school because they had to help support their families, or for whatever reason they were moving all the time and couldn't get education consistently, or they had some kind of disability that was never diagnosed. There's a whole host of reasons, but I think that the main thing is that we tend to believe that everybody in this country is going to sort of go through this system and they're going to get what they need to be good, literate citizens. And that's actually, it's kind of a flawed idea. It doesn't always happen.
Yeah, were you shocked when you learned about all this? I mean, I was.
Well, I learned about it gradually over a period of time. I mean, this has been sort of my big research interest for many years. And I think I came into it first working with immigrants. So, and that's kind of an easy path because you think of immigrants as sort of separate from yourself, and
in their country, they
didn't have blah, blah, blah. And then as you start getting closer and closer, maybe working with more and more Americans, you realize, well, the issues that I'm trying to see as foreign are actually, they're taking place right here in my home, in my own country. Mm-hmm. So it's shocking in a way, but in a way it's not, too, when you think about things like non-literacy being linked to other social problems like poverty and racism and all kinds. I mean, it's really reflecting a lot of other social ills.
It's a scary fact, and I know you're right. It just struck me as my wife, not me, worked with these wonderful people, and they were delightful in every way. Some were immigrants, and I understand that. They want to learn to read and write English and all that. But others were as American as apple pie, okay? And it just always struck me. And I got to tell you, the stigma and the feelings of these people, and you certainly know this better than me, when they are illiterate, is unbelievable. I don't know if you saw. I don't know if you watched. Do you watch Downton Abbey, Lauren?
No, I don't. I know about it, but I don't watch it.
Well, Lauren, you have to get on and watch Downton Abbey. Go to Netflix and watch. But it's great. I love, we're Downton Abbey freaks. But just last episode, one of the folks who works in the house, he was given the opportunity to work on the farm. They gave him some farm books. And it came out that he couldn't read and the stigma that was with it. Now, of course, that's in the Downton Abbey about 1925 or 1927 or something like that. But still, okay, there's a stigma then, there's a stigma now. It's incredible. You know, so what is it? And is it just that stigma, or what is it that prompts people all of a sudden to adults to learn to read? What is it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, no, I just wanted to talk about the stigma for a second.
Sure.
I agree with you that people carry around a stigma, but they also are, like you're saying, so bright, and people who haven't had literacy throughout their lives are also quite clever in developing ways of coping with their non-literacy. They need to protect themselves. They need to be able to get and keep jobs. So besides walking around feeling marked in the way that you're describing, they're also quite clever in figuring out what they need to do to deflect kind of the gaze of bosses or teachers or other people who they know are going to judge them. And I can talk about that more later. But I think that for the people I worked with, coming back to become literate, and they were mostly older adults, they really wanted to study. They really had wanted to study their whole lives. And not just because they felt like there was a lack, but because it was something they really desired. And that's sort of what is at the heart of the book, is that people want this. You know, they want to read, they want to write, they want to be active in their communities in different ways. And for three of the four people who are in the book, they got to attend a literacy center after they retired. They're in their 60s and 70s. It's really fantastic. And what's interesting is, they retired on disability, these three. And I think that if they hadn't become disabled at work, they wouldn't have had that opportunity to stop work and study. And that's, in fact, exactly what they did. Their bodies sort of, they got injured, they got sick, and then they could finally learn to read and write and really spend time on it in this way that they really craved.
And what did these people do? I mean, even if you work a machine, and these days machines are more complicated than ever, in fact, even a box of cling wrap is more complicated than ever. You know, if you read the instructions where to put the cling wrap so that it doesn't go back onto the roll, et cetera. Okay, but everything has instructions on it, and job applications have words. How did they get through without reading?
That's such a good question. No, I can't answer how they filled out job applications without making it up, because I don't know for the exact people I worked with what they did. But I know in general, what people will do with a job application, and it's kind of an indication that they can't read so well, is they'll say, can I take that home? And they'll bring it home so that somebody else can help them fill it out.
Or, I forgot my glasses, I can't see this, or something like that.
I forgot my glasses is the big one. People do it in restaurants, you know, if they can't read the menu. No, I forgot my glasses. What are you ordering? That sounds really good. I think I'll get the same thing.
And it's all just covered up. It's all just covered up.
Yeah, but I think with, you know, getting jobs, I think, you need somebody to help you with the application. But once people have jobs, like I said, they're kind of pretty crafty at keeping the job. One of the men, I'm going to talk about all four people, so I think during our conversation you'll get to know all of them. But one of the men in the book, whose name is George, was actually a very skilled laborer, and that's how he was able to do so well in his life. But he says recently that if he had to go back to work now, that it would be really challenging with the ways that everything's computerized. And how now, before you can use a machine, you have to demonstrate that you know how to use the machine before you get the job using the machine, and that would be really challenging for him if he were back in the workforce now.
Yeah, let me ask, you did a study. That's what the book is based on, okay? Was it you who did the study, or was it other folks and you used the study?
No, it was me. Sorry. It was my study.
Okay, so you did the study. And you're in Connecticut, pretty diverse state. Okay, was there a breakdown of literacy that you illiteracy, I should say, in terms of a geography? And I'm thinking like people from the Deep South versus people from Boston, Massachusetts. Or was there a racial background or anything like that? Could you discern anything like that?
Sure, a little bit.
Sure.
Actually, I did my research in Springfield, Mass., and which is where I live. I work in Connecticut and live in Massachusetts.
Ah, close enough. Yeah.
And it's all very close or close-ish.
That's good. That's just because you want to be near Six Flags. That's all.
That's exactly the reason.
Yeah.
That was my main motivation for selecting
yeah,
that
every
site.
Every day you go and ride a roller
really
coaster.
Really close
you
to Six Flags.
Near, you had to be near Six Flags. Yeah.
And you know, some of that I can address some of the patterns, but some of it I can't, because what's a little bit tricky is that. Adult literacy learners aren't going to always show up in the statistics because they're not participating in
right.
things like
Good
collections
point.
Of census
Good
data.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hate to generalize about, you know, this group is literate, this group is non-literate, because, you know, I think that further labels groups of people.
Yeah, I didn't mean the question that way. I just meant if there was any big breakdown or anything like that. Though I guess the question itself is a certain level of stupidity.
No, it's not, because I mean these are the questions that people often. Oh,
let me tell
ask.
You, a certain level of bias. The question itself
yeah.
has a certain level of bias
well,
in it.
I think that it's a good question. It's a question that people ask because, like you said at the beginning, you're sometimes so shocked to find out
that people don't have
literacy. But to try and answer your question in a real way, I think that when I came to this center, it's called Read Right Now, and it's at a public library, which is not unusual. I think most of our literacy centers in this country are either at library community centers or sometimes faith-based programs, but mine was at a library, and the demographics of the program kind of shift around all the time. But at the time that I was doing research there, about half of the people were Black men. So they weren't African American necessarily. There were Caribbean men, African American men. And so I wanted for my project to sort of represent the demographics of the center, which is how I chose people. So in my group of four, who I wrote about in the study and then in the book, two of them are African American men. One is a Puerto Rican woman, and one is a white woman who's from Springfield. And those four kind of illustrate what the numbers were at the center at the time.
Well, and that in itself, just take one center, and you can extrapolate that out in a lot of ways to understand this. It's just incredible. And, you know, you're a writing teacher. You're teaching literacy. It begs the question, did people want to learn to write or read? Did they discern a difference?
Oh, that's such a good question. That's such
thank
a good
you.
Question because...
Thank you, Professor. Can I get off early for Thanksgiving
you're welcome.
Vacation?
No, I'll tell you right. why I like that question so much, because we're actually just talking about the same thing last night in my literacy studies class at Eastern about the difference between reading and writing. And I think if you ask people, they say they want to read. They don't say, oh, I'm here because I want to, you know, write political pamphlets that are going to challenge everybody's way of thinking. Nobody's going
to
say that, even though some of them can even think that.
Want to, yeah.
But I think people do say they want to read. And I think what they imagine that they sort of desire and have missed is, well, for a lot of people, they say they want to read the Bible. That's sort of the first thing. What do you want to read?
Oh,
I want to read the Bible. I want to read the good
book. That's very interesting.
They want to read the Bible. They want to read the newspaper. They want to read road signs. You know, things that you would imagine that people would
get. Wow, road signs. I didn't even think of that, road signs.
Yeah. You don't want to get lost driving to Florida. But
and wind up in Quebec City. It's not good. Yes,
well,
not
actually,
good. It's a bad vacation in the winter. Yeah,
there's
Quebec
one,
City.
There was one man at the Literacy Center who told this story about, this isn't in the book, but he talked about driving to Florida with his wife, and his wife fell asleep for a few hours, and he woke up and he was in a different state, And that's what made him decide to go back to school.
And, you know, that brings, Lauren, that brings up an interesting question. With GPSs, okay, and with TV, which has been around for so long now, because things are told to you more readily, okay, mm-hmm. certainly GPSs turn right at the next street, okay, anybody can do that, okay. Did you find that less people, with the inflow of electronic information, with audio, are there fewer people who want to learn to read or in this particular illiteracy spot?
I don't think so. I think it's just kind of more stuff that people might have. You know, they might have a GPS. Okay, well, that's one area they can turn it on or not turn it on, but I don't think so. But, you know, if you don't mind, I'd love to say more about your question about reading and writing.
Oh, go ahead, please.
Yeah. Because the one that I thought was such a great question, because
can I get off early for spring vacation, Dr. Rosenberg?
You know, they crave reading so much, and they talk about it, and reading is so celebrated in our culture. Like, we have all these, even kids have, like, read-ins. You know, they have days when they come in their pajamas to school and read all day, and people have memories. There's this great section, there's this wonderful book that's kind of a classic in my field, Literacy in American Lives by Deborah Brandt, and she's got a chapter about people having these wonderful memories of reading with their families, and reading is this sort of lovely, warm event, but exactly the opposite with writing. And I think that I really wanted to highlight this, that people are really writing... has a really different, it's really presented as a really different literacy skill in our culture. It's really undervalued and subordinated to reading, although that's changing now with technology and work and what people are actually doing. But you go into the literacy center and people are really, really nervous about writing. They really feel like that's the thing they can't do. And it's hard. And I think that... you know, for many of us, including professional writers, writing is really hard. It's a really different act from reading. You know, reading, you're just taking everything in. You're taking in all that's around you. And writing, you're producing something. You're making something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're making something that could get you into trouble. And for the adults who attended Read Right Now, a lot of them had really painful memories of writing, of, you know, sort of getting in trouble for writing or not being able to do it and being reprimanded, or just being completely frustrated surrounding the act of writing. So writing something that people, and I mean this for literate and non-literate people, that I think people often shy away from because it's so complex and it's so undervalued.
That's very, that is very interesting. I got to tell you, that's just... you know, writing tends to be like a chore. Reading is fun, and writing tends to be like a chore. That's too bad. You're a writing teacher. I feel terrible. Don't you feel terrible now, Lauren?
Like many other people, I chose to be a writing teacher. But that's, I think, right. Knowing that is maybe a reason that people do choose to teach writing.
Yeah,
because we want to address some of that.
Good point. Wow, incredible. You call the mocking of people who are illiterate. You call that a kind of social violence. That's a very strong term, social violence. Okay. And it's, again, the book is The Desire for Literacy, Writing in the Lives of Adult Learners. Lauren Rosenberg wrote it at ncte.org. Okay. Order or buy the book. Is that good, Lauren? Was that good? That was a good. Buy the book.
I say that every 2 minutes.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, buy the book, The Desire for Literacy. Okay, but you know, social violence, tough words, okay? Why are you saying that?
Okay, well, actually, there are a few sort of important literacy theorists who use the term social violence. I didn't invent it. It is an important concept that was first coined by Paulo Freire, who's an important literacy theorist from Brazil. who also did work with adult farm workers. And then Elspeth Stuckey wrote a book called The Violence of Literacy that also looks at the ways that people are denigrated surrounding their literacy. And the idea that literacy is violence sort of points to the ways that people can be, well, we've actually been talking about it already, the ways that literacy can sometimes be used as a weapon to insult people, to...
What do you mean? Do you have an example of that?
Well, I'll give you a great example of that. Actually, I'm going to give you two examples of that. For a couple of people in the book, they talked really explicitly about ways that bosses, parents, people at church put them down and kind of insulted them for being non-literate. And I want to kind of talk through two examples of that. One is one of the women in the book, whose name is Leanne, is a white woman, grew up in Springfield, and she tells the story that I think is the most violent moment in the book about going to sing in church. She's very religious. She wanted to be part of the people, she says. I wanted to be with the people. She joined the church choir. She starts singing in the choir, and this is a really long story that she tells all the time. And the choir director moves her all around the choir, and eventually he kicks her out of the choir. He publicly humiliates her because she because she can't read the words and she can't read the music. And she tells the story as being the worst moment of her life, and she's had a really difficult time.
Wait a minute. That's music literacy. Most people in a church choir can't read music.
Exactly. But she doesn't really, she can't really, I don't think, distinguish between where he's insulting her for not reading music and where it's about the words, because for her, they're all bound together. She doesn't know how much other people can read music and words, or what it might mean to read music and words. She just knows she doesn't have the music, she doesn't have the words, and eventually at some point, the choir director says, he shouts out to the group, "We don't want anybody here who's hanging on anybody else's coattails."
And, wow, this is a church, this is a church choir
at
director?
At a church.
Hello. So, does he understand what church is supposed to be?
Well, and I think that's a really great example, because she goes to church because she says, you know, church is, she's really been involved in actually a lot of evangelical rhetoric. She really buys this idea of what church is going to give her as a place, as a community, how she wants to be, you know, one with people. She'll go there. She won't be judged. And then she is completely humiliated in church and runs out the door and never comes back. And,
actually, they named a lake in northern Maine where I live after that choir director. It's Lake Schmuck. Right?
Well,
it's beautiful up there.
That's funny. Well, every time Leanne tells the story about the choir director, she'll tell it, and then she'll say, you know, he died. He's
good.
Dead now. But
good.
But I think that her story is a really, it's just a really painful example of how literacy can be used as violence. Like, that choir director clearly knows that she can't read and uses it as a way to kick her out of the choir. The other example that I want...
stupid? Because everybody else thinks everybody who can't read is stupid.
Exactly. I'm sure he thought she was... You know, here are all the labels people are going to say. She's stupid, she's crazy, and... That I think those are some of the things that people will say about non-literate people. But really, she's doing exactly what the choir is set up for. She's going so she can sing in her community. But I think that's a really good example of sort of how extreme it can get. I have another example I wanted to tell you about, which is from one of the men in the study named George. And George, he has a lot to say about the way he could control how people saw him. So he worked at a forge for many years, at a drop forge, he was doing really precision, hot metal work in a team of three men. And he was
I'm very impressed that you're a English professor at Eastern Connecticut and you know what a drop forge is. I didn't even know what that was. I'm very impressed.
Do you think I need to describe more what that word is?
No, it's fine.
Really fascinating.
Like a blacksmith guy.
A little bit like what modern blacksmithing would be like. I think where George worked, and I actually, you know, I know about it from him. He taught me about his work.
But I'm still impressed because I'm old and I never heard the words hot forge. I've heard hot fudge, but never hot forge before. So I'm very impressed with that. But please continue.
Yeah, it's actually drop forge. They call it the drop shop where he worked.
Drop forge.
And it's a hot, sort of heavy process of creating templates for big metal jobs. Like they'd make golf clubs, and they made airplane parts for Pratt & Whitney and the Sears Craftsman sets. So they would make the templates so that it could be for mass production, which is really fascinating.
Cool. That is cool.
And I think George is such a great example for people to know about because his work was so precise and it required such great skill, and yet he hadn't really had any schooling. And he claims that he really had trouble writing more than his name for many years. But he was very good at developing his own methods for doing math. He had to create his own formulas. And he was, he was really good at. I don't want to say hiding because I don't mean hiding, but sort of keeping bosses
disguising.
Yeah, disguising his non-literacy. So, and he used to brag that he was the second highest paid man in his shop of 300 men, which is really quite impressive. But George talks a lot about the strategies he would develop for sort of keeping bosses from knowing, or he's very sensitive about it. And I have picked out an area where I wanted to read to you where George talks about a boss giving you something knowing you can't read. So this is a section of an interview, actually, where I wanted to read this because George is talking about literacy as violence. He says, let's say a group of people sitting around. He or she knows some of these people can't read or write. Now, why give a person, let's say, a sheet of paper like this with all these words on it? Now, you know good and well he or she could not read this paper, and you know it in your heart that they couldn't. Why would you do that, you know, to embarrass people around other people? And I'm talking about, and then he goes on, well, this may embarrass you. You know they couldn't read. I could see somebody do that didn't know, what do you say, I didn't know she couldn't read, or I wouldn't have given them word. But somebody do it intentionally, knowing that a person can't read, I think that's a shameful thing to do to a person. You know what I mean? And then George goes on and talks about this some more, about experiences he's had where a boss will go to somebody and say, here, you need to read this, and knowing the person can't read.
Yeah,
and
right.
What's so fascinating to me about that is that George is exactly echoing the professional theorists I was talking about, Stuckey and Frary, when he says, you know, how that dynamic works and how it's used to sort of control the other person and have power over them.
It's just that's an astounding fact that people. I guess it isn't because I've worked with enough dopey bosses, but it's we all have. But it's amazing somebody would use that and use it to make fun of somebody and hold them back and make them feel bad. It's just it's just the wrong side of human nature, I got to tell you. What's the youngest, and I don't know if you know this, like the kids who get through school now can't read, okay? When do they suddenly realize they have to learn to read? Is there any statistic on like 20-year-olds heading back to school rather than 60-year-olds?
It's our culture is so controlled by testing and school testing that those are sort of the things that make people act. Like I remember when I was doing research at Read Right Now, there were younger, and when I say younger, I mean 18, people who would come there because they hadn't passed the MCAS, which was the Massachusetts State exam that you needed to graduate from high school. So, you know, we're sort of controlled by standardized testing.
Why didn't they go to their high school counselor and say, why didn't a teacher a professional educator know that these kids can't read? How could they give them the MCATs if they can't read? Hello?
Maybe the teacher wasn't paying attention. No,
and
I'm not joking.
I don't mean to yell at you, Lauren. That's really a concern. That some idiot gave them MCATs when they can't read. Didn't somebody notice, hello, they can't read at Springfield High School or Boston Latin or wherever? Didn't they notice? Jeez.
Well, I mean, I think it happens all the time, sadly. You know, kids get unnoticed. Or what about, like, the child who changes schools two or three times a year because, you know, the family keeps moving, they keep changing jobs, they keep getting new apartments.
There are plenty of kids. I talk to a lot of districts with migrant laborers.
Yeah, there are plenty of kids who get completely unnoticed, or they don't drop out, they don't attend. Kids fall through the cracks all the time.
They do.
And
they
you know,
do, but
it's unfortunate.
It's just unbelievable. They can't read. And I, what astounds me is that they would give them the MCATs. It just doesn't even make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because
well,
there is no audio book of the MCAT. Let me make that point. It doesn't come off as an audio book. Okay?
Although there is a visual test. There is an audio test for driver's license. And
well,
that was actually
news.
That was one of the really curious things about the learners at Reed right now is that most of them had cars and had passed a driving exam.
Well,
and
don't
some
forget
of them
they're
were
going
really
to be
proud of that.
Don't forget they're going to be driving in Boston. Rules don't matter. Don't even worry about that. Right, right. One-way street. Who are you kidding me? Right? It's incredible. Lauren, we got to go. This has been wonderful. But really, this is just fascinating stuff. It's great. And I know Millie Davis over at NCTE is listening, and I'm going to ask her to send me your book.
Oh, fantastic. That would be great.
Okay. And I know, Millie, I know you're listening, that you will do that. Okay. So
okay.
This is great, Laura. This is terrific. Keep it up, and it's really important. It's something we don't talk about very much. So I really love doing the show with you.
Great. Well, thank you, Larry. I enjoy talking with you also.
Well, my pleasure. And I'll leave you with these words: enjoy Six Flags.
Okay, I'm on my way. Okay.
I know. Nothing like Six Flags in February. I mean, it's just nothing like going down a roller coaster in February in Springfield. Laura, have a great day. Okay.
You
thank
too.
You.
Bye, Larry.
Great. Bye-bye. Right. Six Flags, as I think you all know, if I may, is the amusement park, and is right outside of Springfield, Mass. Okay? Which is a pretty cool town, by the way. Okay? A little beat up these days, but a pretty good town. And that's a good part of the world out there in Western Massachusetts. Okay. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org. Tweet it out at EduTalkRadio. Let me tell you the name of the book again. NCTE.org is where you go. National Council of Teachers of English, Lauren Rosenberg, The Desire for Literacy, Writing in the Lives of Adult Learners is what it's about, but it's about everything in terms of literacy in the lives of adult learners, and it's based on the NCTE Studies in Writing and Rhetoric, and that's a series. Okay, so check it all out. You can just go over to ncte.org/store, and I'm sure you'll find it. Okay, I got to thank Great Books Foundation, which actually is a perfect sponsor for this particular show in terms of, hello, making sure kids can read, okay, letting become reflective thinkers about it, and discussion of written works, ideas of enduring value. You become independent reader, independent thinker. We got to catch them young. Hello. They have a shared inquiry method of learning, okay, and your school should look at putting it all together with them. Greatbooks.org. And they tweeted Great Books FND. Thank you, Chris, for doing that. Millie, send me the book. I'll send you an email in a few minutes. That was a great show. I really enjoyed it. As I say, my wife had wonderful experiences with that. It is a heartwarming thing to teach an adult to read and write, one who can. It's just amazing. So, and don't let your kids slip through the cracks. That's all I have to say on the subject. Thank you for listening. Lauren, you were wonderful. Millie, thanks a million. Chris over at Great Books, thank you. I'm Larry Jacobs. This is 3K Adult Education Talk Radio. Thanks for listening.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Today, Bridget Griffin shared a video of her daily yoga routine, two self-help articles, and her new blog called Build Your Inner Bridge with Bridge. Girl, your sharing has turned into oversharing. No worries, Bridge. Geico has some info worth sharing with your 7 blog followers, like how you could save money on your car insurance, update your policy, and report a claim just by visiting geico.com. How's that for building your inner bridge? Bridge. Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.